The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. As always, thank you for subscribing and listening and downloading. Please do share a podcast link with someone you think may like the show. We really appreciate you letting people know about Future Proof. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Amy Milton. She is a neuroscientist and psychologist at Cambridge University, and she is looking at the potential of editing memories in human beings. She's particularly interested in patients with PTSD who have had a traumatic episode that keeps recurring and keeps causing them pain throughout their life. Is it possible to open up that memory and edit it to make it less painful? Really exciting research, and we are really looking forward to this extended podcast interview with her today. If you'd like to comment on this show, share some of your experiences, particularly if you've had PTSD, what it's like and what memories you have and how they're triggered. If you'd like to share those, we would love to hear them. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're @NewstalkScience. Now, before we get into the podcast, all this weekend on News Talk, we're asking people to wear a mask. And I wanted to say two things about it, because obviously you've heard that 60% of people wearing the mask 60% of the time will protect us from COVID-19 and get us back to some sense of normality. And the science when it comes to masks is pretty conclusive. So that to me is really not up for debate. But there's two things I want to say that I've noticed. One is I forget my mask. It's like the new bag for life. You walk out of the house, you open up your boot, and you realize you haven't brought your plastic bag to go shopping. It's the same with masks. We need to get into the habit. So have a few masks in the house, have a few masks hanging on the door handle as you leave the house, and have some in the car, those disposable masks, in case you find yourself stuck. And if you walk 100 meters from your house and forget, turn around and go back and get your mask. When we get to this level of complete normality of wearing masks, that's when everybody will just feel a little bit awkward to be the only person not doing it. There's great social science on this. If we all wear a mask, people will feel uncomfortable not wearing them. To add to that, though, let's not actively make people feel uncomfortable if they're not wearing a mask. There may be reasons why they can't wear a mask for medical reasons, but also sometimes you just get stuck. And while it's always preferable to be wearing a mask, let's not add to people's stress, because stress levels are so high at the moment everywhere, by making them feel awful because they've forgotten the mask. Let's just be tolerant, and everyone will get the message over time. There's no need to polarize our society. They're my thoughts and my opinions, but please do wear a mask to protect yourself and others, and get into the habit this weekend so we can continue as we mean to go on. Right, it's time to look back at the week's science stories, and joining me via Skype is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and a science communicator and broadcaster Phil Smith. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Is there life on Mars? Our first story has to do with Mars, and this week saw a third mission to Mars, Phil, where NASA have sent their biggest machine ever. I think I'm going to do something in more detail on Perseverance, because it's an amazing machine and amazing mission. But this is to do with our concept of life on Mars.
It's like, Jonathan, but not as we know it, because research is suggesting that the standard definition of life may be too restrictive for the complexities of space. So it is Mars season at the moment. Every 26 months, we get a little bit closer to Mars. So this is why there's three Mars missions have been launched around now. And researchers from Caltech and the University of Washington have been looking at the definition of life, because there actually isn't really a standardized definition that everybody agrees on. So what they're looking at is when missions like Perseverance go up, they might not see life that is what we call analogous to life on Earth. So what they mean by that is life that is very similar to life on Earth. So it's ones that has the same building blocks, the same amino acids, the DNA, RNA might be a little bit different. So by broadening the spectrum of, or the scope of what they, how they define life, they may be able to kind of redefine what they're looking for, but hopefully what they might find. So they've called it this new life, which is life with a Y, because it's actually a redundant word spelling of the of life itself from medieval times. But they're now defining a living organism, which is L-Y-V-I-N-G, as having four criteria. So dissipation is the ability to harness and convert free energy sources. Autocatalysis, which means the ability to grow or expand exponentially. Homeostasis, which is the ability to limit change internally when things change externally, so that you'll be able to regulate, say, body temperature or things that happen, as an example. And learning, the ability to record and process. So with this definition, life is just one specific instance of L-Y-F-E, life. So they're saying that they're increasing the probability of finding life on Mars with Perseverance by moving the goalposts. And they think that the life on Mars, they're more likely to get it. Now, they're going to a crater, the Jezero crater, which used to be a lake, and it used to have an inlet and an outlet. So they think it's a great place for microorganisms to grow. But life, L-Y-F-E, is kind of harder to find, they believe, because they might have to drill down. So
this is a terrible communications exercise by...
It's a little bit. Yeah, they could have called it something different.
But can I ask, are there organisms that would fall into this category that obviously rocks and minerals are not living, but are there on Earth any organisms that we wouldn't call L-I-F-E, this is ridiculous, that we might call L-Y-F-E?
Yes, so they do fit it. So they're feeling that this is kind of a broader definition. So life, L-Y-F-E, will fit in with inside L-I-F-E.
No,
it's hard to just say life is life. I mean, and life, I feel like I should be singing, oh, life, do. But yeah, we're grand.
I honestly don't know where to go with that. I think the idea of expanding our definition of life is interesting. I think communicating that clearly is obviously not something that these researchers have thought about particularly well.
No, not really.
Ruth, our second story, but like either way, if they find anything that's close to that, it'd be very exciting on Mars.
Hugely exciting.
Absolutely. Ruth, our second story has to do with the level of dementia in the population, how we might delay or prevent it using just lifestyle changes. Now, can you tell us about this study?
Yeah, so this is a study that came out this week from The Lancet, and it's a follow-on study from work that was published in 2017, where a large group of scientists and experts got together and looked at the evidence for lifestyle interventions in preventing dementia. And back in 2017, they came up with 9 potentially modifiable risk factors for preventing dementia. And those were things that we've probably all heard about, so lower education levels, high blood pressure, hearing impairment, smoking, obesity, depression, physical inactivity, diabetes, and having low levels of social contact. Now, since 2017, they've continued to accumulate evidence for those factors, and they're finding it's only getting stronger. And on top of that, this week, they've added 3 additional factors. So those 3 new factors that have only been published this week are excessive alcohol consumption, traumatic brain injury, and air pollution. So the authors of this study, it's led by Professor Gil Livingston from the Division of Psychiatry in University College London. They've looked at all of the well-controlled studies out there that relate to dementia to come up with these factors that are potentially modifiable. And they've worked out that around 40% of worldwide dementias could be prevented or delayed if we could essentially bring all of these risk factors to zero or to an optimum level for everyone.
Right. Okay. But we can't really get them to zero.
We can't get them to, well, I mean, something like smoking, we could potentially get to zero. You know, we could. And it's interesting, obviously, when you look at COVID-19, you know, some of the risk factors here, like obesity, are also connected. And, you know, we can see in the UK, there's a big push now, a government plan to try and get people, I think it's to lose 5 pounds or, you know, to reduce their body weight. So, I mean, interestingly, when you look at the factors that have the biggest impact, that early childhood education has a huge impact. And it's really fascinating, because what early education does is do something that builds up something called your cognitive reserve. And your cognitive reserve, that sort of background of ability to get things done, even when the situation changes, this plasticity that a well-functioning brain has, So that, you know, that's one of the things that's come up here. The other thing is hearing loss. What they're saying is if people are losing their hearing, particularly early on, and we've discussed this before, you know, it's actually a really good idea to think about using some sort of hearing aid, because the impact on your cognitive function when you're straining to hear is actually cancelled out by hearing aids. So, you know, even something like trying to get rid of stigma around hearing aids would be a great public health intervention here. Yeah. Because that's a big factor. So, you know, I think there's loads of interesting information here about, I mean, obviously things like brain injury, that's easy to understand if you're going to have a sort of pathological change in the brain that might contribute to dementia. But there's lots of positive messages here around things that we can actually do. And I think that's really helpful because it's not an exciting new pill. And often these things are difficult.
Phil, our third story, this is a really cool one. And it's to do with new materials being developed in space in a way that they couldn't be down on Earth.
Yeah, this is actually incredibly exciting because you might have a new fab is like when you see something like made in China, made in Ireland, made in US, now there might be made in space. And that for me is awesome because it's new. And also that there's more careers in space. So we might eventually get up there. So this is actually coming from a company conveniently called Made in Space, which are based in Florida. Thor Labs, who are kind of one of the world's largest manufacturers of fiber optics, actually whose CEO is called Alex Cable, which to me blows my mind because this is a story about fiber optics and cable. And every time you talk on the phone, go on the internet, or how we're hearing now, it's traveling to fiber optic cables that are around the world. And they're made from glass. So on Earth, the way that it's a flexible, transparent fiber made by drawing glass, which is usually silica, that you kind of have a tube that you glue together with another tube, you spin it, you heat it, you create a layer of soot on the middle of it and extrude it and kind of like let it drop down and get thinner and thinner and thinner. And then you do different heat processes on it. And then total internal reflection, which is how the light bounces down that pipe, you're able to send light pulses and effectively signals and communications. And through this kind of extruding and process, you have gravity affecting it, you have the pull of it. So there's the different kind of physical effects that are happening on this mechanical process. So if you're able to make this in space, you're in microgravity, what happens is it produces way less tiny imperfections in the glass. So basically what will happen is that it's theorized that the performance by creating a better product means you'll be able to make clearer glass. So if you imagine that on a microscopic level, when you pull something out and it has a weight in one particular direction, tiny crystals form in this glass. Whereas if you form it in microgravity, because there's not that pull down in one direction, it forms much more evenly and you don't get these impurities in it.
So what's the potential of this, Phil?
Huge, absolutely huge. You're looking at about 100 times increase in the performance of these of signals.
Wow.
Having something made in space, what's really exciting about the data performance and lowering the cost, which is big for data centers in Ireland, but it's something that could affect everyone in the world and make it more easy for communications to happen and quicker.
I love the insane engineering that goes into fiber optics, and now making it in space is only making it more perfect. The idea of these thin glass tubes that bounce light around, it's just, I mean, that to me is what I love about human ingenuity and design and science. And Ruth, our final story takes a look backwards to potentially help us going forwards.
Yes, from fiber optics to medieval medicine. So this is work that was published this week from researchers at the University of Warwick. And this work, again, started a few years ago. And it started with a lady called Christina Lee from the School of English in the University of Nottingham. And she went back to look at a very old manuscript from the 9th century called Bald's Leech Book. And it was an old leather-bound book of medical remedies. Now, I thought leech book was an obvious sort of insight into medieval medicine, but actually leech, talking of the origin of words like life, leech is actually the old English word for a medical doctor. So this was just a medical doctor's book.
Nice.
But the researchers this week went back and made some of the compounds that were in this book. So they were made with fairly normal ingredients, and they made a mixture called Bald's Eye Salve, and it was made of garlic and wine and bile salts and onion and things like this that you find right mixed up in a particular combination. But they found that this had very, very significant antibacterial properties, which was surprising, because while we know that some of these things have very mild antibacterial properties, this was, when you combine them together, it was much, much more effective. Now, bacteria live in different ways. So when we look at bacteria in the lab, we often look at the cells floating around in a medium or a liquid. And that's called the planktonic form of bacteria. But when they get into a wound or they're causing an infection, bacteria kind of band together into a city, which we call a biofilm. And a biofilm is a very, very complex, almost like a multicellular organism. And the bacteria in the biofilm can turn on different genes, and it can make it much, much harder to get rid of those bacteria. But in fact, they found this Boll's iSalve was effective against a number of different biofilms. So they looked at least five different types of bacterial biofilms, particularly those associated with skin infections and some lung infections, and they found that it was very effective. So they're very excited about this, particularly because when you look at some of the range of bacteria that are killed by this salve, they're related to diabetic foot ulcers. And at the moment, there's no really good treatment for badly infected diabetic foot ulcers.
It sort of gives you an interesting insight into what we know and what we don't know, because you'd imagine these things that are, you know, as you say, household, they're almost kitchen ingredients. You'd imagine we would know exactly what these things can and can't do because we've had them around so in such abundance. They're not complex. But the idea that to mix them together makes them much more potent than we thought kind of opens up a whole world of potential kitchen science that we're not familiar with. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and science communicator Phil Smith, thanks very much. Do you remember when we used to go to football matches and gigs, and if someone scored or if the band played a particular banger, we'd hug each other and jump up and down? It's nice to let your mind wander back like that to the moment, isn't it? But equally, you'll likely have a very vivid memory of this pandemic 10 years from now. Memories aren't always nice or even helpful. So what if we could erase the ones we don't want? Could it be possible? And should we do it? Well, Amy Milton is Senior Lecturer in Psychology and Ferris Willetts Fellow in Neuroscience at Cambridge University. She joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Amy. Why are you interested in memories?
I'm really interested in memories from a therapeutic perspective. There are a number of different mental health disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder and even disorders like drug addiction and potentially obsessive compulsive disorder, that have some component of maladaptive memory to them. And so I'm really interested in understanding how memory works from a basic perspective, but also with an eye to ultimately being able to develop treatments for some very, very distressing mental health disorders.
So I've read a few headlines over the years that made me think that we've come closer to understanding how memory is deposited in the brain. Is memory a physical thing? Are all of our memories of childhood, of first kisses, of that time we really embarrassed ourselves in front of our co-workers, are they material things in our brain?
That is the idea. So the notion is that there are memory traces stored within the brain, and those are stored as patterns of activation of particular brain cells. That these are stored in different brain areas, depending on the type of memory it is, because it's important to realise there isn't just one single type of memory, but there are lots of different types of memory that depend more or less on different brain structures.
Could you take us through the different types of memories and where they're stored in the brain?
Of course. So there's short-term and long-term memory. So I'll focus on long-term memory because that's normally what we mean when we talk about memory. And even within long-term memory, there are two major different classes of long-term memory. So the first type is known as declarative or explicit memory. And it's declarative because you can declare these memories in words. And it's explicit because you know the content of those memories. So this would include memories like memories for events, which we refer to as episodic memory because it's referring to particular episodes. That's what we normally mean when we talk about memory conversationally? You know, when was the last time you went to a football match or you went to the pub before the pandemic and remembering that and so on? But another type of declarative memory would be memory for facts, which of course you can pass on in words. But there's another type of memory, another big class, which is known as non-declarative or implicit memory. And as the name implies, you can't pass those memories on in words, and you probably don't have conscious access to the content of those memories.
What?
So the classic example that's used is motor memory. So something like learning to ride a bike. You will know if you can ride a bike or not, but if you were asked to try and describe the process of bike riding in words, in a way that somebody else could, you know, ride a bike based on your instructions, it's basically impossible. Like, which muscles should you tense and how should you adjust your balance and how fast do you need to pedal? It's really hard. You can only acquire those memories through practice, essentially.
Are those memories stored in a totally different place to the memories of our past, my day at the beach, the time my girlfriend broke up with me, etc.?
Yes, that's right. So the memories for particular sort of events and episodes depend really strongly on this region known as the hippocampus, which is a little seahorse-shaped structure, just sort of close to the ears, sort of in the medial temporal lobe. The memories for sort of motor learning, for example, depend on completely different structures like the cerebellum, which is this tiny little brain at the back of the head, and areas like the motor cortex, which, you know, are activated when we're making movements.
The way we figure that out is sort of by accident, in a way. Would you tell us a little bit about Henri Malaison?
Of course. So Henri Malaison is a really, really, or was a really influential patient in the field of memory. So Henri Malaison had very, very severe epilepsy, and it became clear by his sort of mid-20s that his epilepsy was just not being controlled properly with the medications that were available at the time. This was sort of in the 1950s. So because he was having such severe epileptic episodes and, you know, was unable to live independently because of this, he and his parents decided that they should go down the route of neurosurgery. And they saw a neurosurgeon called William Scoville, who had some success in treating epileptic patients by removing parts of the brain that were the cause of the epilepsy. So for Henry, he had both of his hippocampi removed. You have one hippocampus on each side of the brain, and he had both of them taken out back in 1957. And so Scoville does the operation, but quite shortly afterwards, it becomes very clear that Henry doesn't remember the nurses who have just been tending to him. And he really doesn't remember any events from the point of the operation onwards. He develops what we refer to as anterograde amnesia, or he basically develops this inability to make new memories about events from the time of the surgery onwards.
So he can't remember anything that has just happened.
Exactly. So he could remember for sort of somewhere around 5 to 15 minutes of what had just happened. But after, you know, after about 15 minutes, the information was just gone. So he was studied for many, many years by a psychologist called Brenda Milner, who Scoville contacted after it became clear that Henry was having these problems with his memory. And even though Milner worked with Henry for decades, he never actually learned who she was. Every time she met him, she had to reintroduce herself as Dr. Milner, who was going to be doing some experiments with him. But he worked with Milner and her students right up until he passed away in 2008. And at that point, he donated his brain to science as well. So we have a huge amount of information about Henri Malaison, not only all of the behavioral tests that were conducted when he was alive and brain scans that were conducted when he was alive, but also his actual brain and the brain tissue that he donated after his death.
when we think of memories, I'm trying to figure out whether or not there's something physical at the end of it. Do we know? Is there a protein? Is there a strengthening of a particular neuron? Is there more fluid somewhere? Or do we know what it is that a memory physically is? Or are we sure that it is something physical yet?
So there's really good evidence that when a memory is made, networks of neurons, brain cells, communicate with each other in a different way. So the points at which brain cells communicate with each other are known as synapses. And some of those synapses, when you make a memory, get stronger, and some of them get weaker. And we know a lot about the processes in quite a lot of detail that are involved in synaptic strengthening and in synaptic weakening. So we know particular receptors become more expressed. We know particular receptors have to get activated. We know lots about the cell having to make new protein in order to support these changes that are happening in the brain cell. What is still being sought after, I guess, by neuroscience is connecting up this very, very detailed information at a very, very small level and connecting that right up to behavior at a whole organism level.
When you were talking about non-declarative memory, the sort of memories that we have that we can't really put into words, emotional memories would be within this class, is that right? And that's why you're interested in trying to figure out how memory works in terms of therapy.
That's right. So these emotional memories influence our behavior in ways that we're not necessarily consciously aware of. So the sound of the ice cream van, for example, that nice tinkly music often puts you in quite a good mood, because you might not remember any individual instance from childhood where the tinkly music was paired with ice cream, but it has been paired with ice cream, and that's a good noise because of that. So there are lots of different cues in our environment that trigger particular behaviors. And if, of course, if it's the sound of the ice cream van putting you in a good mood, then that's a completely adaptive and perfectly normal thing. But in certain mental health disorders, and post-traumatic stress is probably the sort of, I guess, the classic one you would think about this, particular cues in the environment can trigger really distressing recollections and symptoms, such as flashbacks and really strong fear responses and huge psychological distress.
Do they really happen, Amy? Because I always thought that was the stuff of TV, but it wasn't really based in any actual science. I mean, often we see in a movie someone who's been to to the front line or whatever, and they hear a loud bang and they jump, and then they are they have this memory that then they affects them. I always thought that was a sort of a dramatization, but people with PTSD, this does happen to them. There are cues in their environment that sort of that bring them into a very high level of stress. As simplistic as that.
Yes, exactly. So Mike Davis, who's over in the US, described one of his patients who was a Vietnam War veteran, and this chap's wedding day, and he's done up in his nice white tuxedo, and everybody's outside the church and everyone's taking photos, milling around, sort of perfectly normal wedding. And then the wedding car backfires. And of course, the sound of the car backfiring is just like a gunshot. And before this guy knows what he's doing, he's dived under a bush and completely covered his white tux in mud and dirt, because the immediate reaction on hearing that sound was to dive for cover. So these cues can trigger really, really powerful behavioral responses.
Okay, so those are the things that we don't want to happen. They're unhealthy, they can be dangerous, and they can lead to, I suppose in some instances, they might lead to violent episodes. Can you then tell us a little bit about your work in trying to figure out how to edit these memories?
So we became really interested in trying to edit these memories exactly for that reason, that these trigger cues unconsciously influence behavior. It can be really difficult even to try and identify what these trigger cues are, but it can be done with working through them with a very good therapist. So we know that these trigger cues and the psychological and neurobiological processes that support learning about these trigger cues is really, really highly conserved across the animal kingdom. I mean, if you think about what that system has evolved for, it's to protect us from predators and, you know, dangerous situations. So there's a really good reason for all animals to have these kind of responses. So we were able to study this in rodent models. And the advantage, of course, with rodents is you know exactly what they've been exposed to and you know when they learned it and exactly what they learned. So what we wanted to know is it possible to disrupt these emotional memories long after they've been acquired in a rodent model?
So you presumably then have to induce a Pavlovian response to something unpleasant for these mice or rats, is that right?
That's right. So for we use rats and we use a mild electric foot shock when we're working with the animals. It's enough to be unpleasant, but not enough to cause, you know, any kind of damage to their paws or even actually to make them vocalize. So it's unpleasant, but it's not sort of overtly painful, but it's enough to make them learn about these trigger cues, and they learn very well and very, very quickly. And so the main thing that we wanted to know was, is it possible to target these memories, to weaken these memories long after they've been acquired, after they've been learned? Because the traditional view of memory suggests that you have to try and stop a memory from being stored within a few hours of a learning experience. And if you're thinking about that from the perspective of, you know, disorders like post-traumatic stress, it's not really practical or even, you know, feasible to try to target those memories immediately after they've been learned. And also, what about people who've had traumatic events, you know, many, many years, if not decades ago? You don't want to sort of rule treatment for them. So we became really interested in a process known as reconsolidation, which was discovered around the turn of the century. This basically says that rather than a memory being permanently stored forever after it's been learned, actually, memories are far more dynamic than that. And they go through these repeated rounds of going into a state where they can be modified and updated and then being restored in the brain in that updated form. So it seemed to us that...
Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah, so this is thought to underlie false memories, actually. Psychology had appreciated this way before neuroscience had. So Elizabeth Loftus, for example, has done some really, really nice work showing that you can effectively implant false memories in people if you do it sort of in the right way.
We interviewed her on that very subject a few years ago.
Ah, yes, she's fantastic. So I'm sure she told you about all of her various experiments, like her Lost in the Mall experiments, where you can convince people that they were lost in a shopping centre as a child if, you know, you get their family to tell them all of this detail about, you know, how they got lost. People will actually then reconstruct a whole narrative around that, and they will come up with details that no one told them, but they are convinced happened. And I think probably my favorite Loftus experiment is the one where in some highly suggestible participant, she managed to produce false memories of having met Bugs Bunny at Disneyland, which of course is impossible because Bugs Bunny's a Warner Brothers character and he wouldn't have been there. But people were, you know, giving her all of this detail about, you know, who they went with, what the weather was like, what it was like to meet Bugs Bunny, all of this rich detail that sounds like a convincing memory. And people were convinced it happened, but was all to do with just introducing misinformation into a memory that was in a state where it could be updated.
You sort of talk about memories as if there's an open and closed mode to them, where when they're open, you can fiddle about with them, and when they're closed, you can't. Is that the theory?
That's the idea. So The way to think about it is that memories go through, these repeated rounds of being modifiable. So we refer to them as being in the active state and being sort of stable and persistent. And we refer to this as the inactive state. And getting them to go into the active state is kind of, it's fairly common sense, actually, what you would need to do to get them to go into the active state. So they become modifiable when you're introducing new information, when there's some kind of surprise or your expectations are violated in some way. You thought something was going to go a certain way and it didn't quite work out like that. And of course, that's exactly the situation where you would want to be updating a memory, because if that memory is incorrect, then it needs to be updated so that next time you come to use it, it's more accurate.
So tell me about propranolol then, and its use in potentially allowing us to edit these memories.
Propranolol is a really interesting drug from this perspective because it acts on beta adrenergic receptors. Now, adrenergic receptors, of course, detect adrenaline, and adrenaline is released in stressful situations, but actually any situation where there's a very strong emotional component to that situation. And it's been known for decades that emotional memories tend to be better remembered than memories that aren't emotional. So we tend to remember events, big events like birthdays or anniversaries more than we would sort of any random Tuesday or whatever. So if there's an emotional aspect to a memory, we are more likely to remember it.
Yeah.
It's thought that adrenaline contributes to that. So all of the normal processes that would store a memory are enhanced when adrenaline is in the system, and particularly for this type of memory, this is all happening in a structure called the amygdala, which is this little almond-shaped structure that sits right next to the hippocampus, actually, so within the medial temporal lobe of the brain. So the amygdala is normally storing these memories, but if there's adrenaline in the system, this just ramps everything up and those memories become much stronger.
Right.
Now,
And so that would that count for stressful times too? Does stress cause that adrenaline surge that might code the memory stronger?
absolutely. So in very, very stressful situations, so like in trauma, for example, adrenaline will make that memory very, very strong, particularly that emotional component of the memory very, very strong, which is why in PTSD, those trigger cues are so good at eliciting this psychological distress and so good at triggering these behaviors because those memories are really, really strong.
When we're stressed, does detail suffer or does it improve?
It depends on how stressed you are.
Oh.
So if you're a little bit stressed, it's kind of we call it an inverted U-shaped curve. So if you're a little bit stressed, a little bit stressed out, you bring in lots of detail, you encode these memories really, really well, you tend to remember them really, really well. But if you go too far along that curve, if you get too stressed, what you find is that attention narrows. So we don't tend to remember peripheral details, we tend to focus in on specific details, often the specific details that then go on to become these trigger cues.
Right.
And adrenaline has different effects on the hippocampus and the amygdala, and especially in the context of other stress hormones as well, like you would see in trauma. So typically, what you see in a traumatic event for someone who will go on to develop PTSD is that the hippocampus effectively stops working. So you're not encoding the time of the trauma, the place where the trauma happened. You haven't got that context to put that traumatic event into. But the amygdala, which is encoding those trigger cues, does so really, really well. So rather than having a memory where you know that, that sound or that sight, was a bad thing when you were on the battlefield in Vietnam, but it's not now that you're safe at home. Instead of having that, what you have is a trigger cue that works anywhere, anytime.
We're listening to Amy Milton. She's a neuroscientist at Cambridge University, and we're talking about the nature of memories and whether or not it might be possible to edit rather than necessarily delete unpleasant memories. And I presume that is the aim, right? To not delete bad memories, but to make them less stressful and less traumatic.
Absolutely. The aim of our research is essentially to take a patient with post-traumatic stress disorder and to make them more like someone who has lived through trauma but doesn't have post-traumatic stress disorder, rather than getting rid of the memory of the trauma completely.
So how do you do that with propranolol then? Presumably you've done this in rodent models. What have you found?
So we have done all of our work has been in rodent models, but there are other labs in the world. So Merrill Kint at the University of Amsterdam, Alain Brunet at McGill in Canada, who have done small scale trials with human patients. And some of our collaborators have done some studies in healthy human participants who've been through a trauma analog procedure.
Wow.
So what we did with what we've done with our rodent models is to train them up to learn about these trigger cues and then get the memory to go into this modifiable state. Now, we do this by giving them a reminder of what they'd learned previously, but with that element of surprise, that sort of violation of expectation. So typically what we will do is if they learn that a sound is paired with this aversive event, we will then present the sound on its own, so with no aversive outcome, in a very, very brief session, which reminds them and gets the memory back into that state where it can be modified. If you then give your drug like propranolol or other drugs that we have used drugs that are similar to ketamine, or you can do some behavioral interference approaches as well, effectively what you can do at that point is weaken the memory while it's in that modifiable state. And then when you test the animals later on, and we typically test them for our fear work, we've tested them for sort of a week or so after that single treatment. In some of the work that we've done with rodent models of drug addiction, we've tested them up to a month after their last, that treatment experience. And what you find is a persistent reduction in the response to that trigger cue.
I mean, it sounds absurd that you might be able to do this, but it sounds like there is a good body of evidence to suggest that it works.
Yes. So there's evidence across species. So there's evidence from everything from crabs to mice to rats to humans. It seems to be a very, very highly conserved process. And if you think about memory as being about looking forward, so I think for me, one of the key things that really sort of influenced my understanding of memory was some work by Daniel Schachter suggesting that actually memory is not about looking back, it's about looking forward and trying to predict the future and how should you behave in similar situations next time you encounter one like you have before. If you think about memory in those terms, actually having this updating process makes complete sense, because you're just continually refining how good your models of the world are.
Yeah. What about for people who can't take propranolol or, are there alternatives to this drug that might be a little less invasive?
So, yeah, we have been really interested in working out if there are non-drug alternatives to modify these memories while they're in that active, modifiable state. And actually, one of the techniques that I've used with one of my collaborators, Emily Holmes, who's now based at Karolinska, is Tetris. So the logic of Tetris, it sounds a bit outlandish, but there is a logic to it. So we were really interested in flashback symptoms, or something like flashback symptoms, in PTSD patients. You can model this in healthy participants by getting them to do a procedure called the trauma film procedure. That basically means getting them to watch sort of 10 to 15 minutes of really quite unpleasant imagery. So clips like eye surgery, those Think road safety traffic adverts, Martin Scorsese's The Big Shave, there's lots of these little film clips that have really quite disturbing images in them. And for healthy participants, these images will pop back into mind as kind of intrusive thoughts over the course of about a week after they've watched the film, and then it will gradually go away. So we have, well, Emily's group have used that trauma film procedure as an analogue of flashbacks for PTSD. Now, of course, in PTSD, the flashbacks don't go away by themselves, but you can use this procedure in the short term to try to see if you can influence how frequently these flashback-like phenomena happen. Now, for the trauma films, these intrusive thoughts of the films are very, very visual. The things that come back to mind are the really unpleasant bits of the film, and you see them in your mind's eye. We know from decades of psychology research that if you are taxing certain memory stores, you can't do another task that taxes the same memory store at the same time. So if you think about, if you're driving your car and you're singing along to the radio, you're absolutely fine doing that because you're singing along to the radio using sort of more auditory based memory, and you're driving using visuospatial memory. But if you were to try and sing along to the radio while you're typing an email, that's basically impossible because you're trying to think of the words you want to say using auditory based memory, and you're trying to sing with auditory based memory, and these two things interfere with each other. It's the same logic with the Tetris. So we know that the memories that are like flashbacks in the trauma film procedure are really, really highly visual. So what we wanted to test was if we could get those into a modifiable state and then get people to play, it's about 20 minutes worth of Tetris, could we then effectively introduce so much noise into that visual memory that it becomes meaningless and then doesn't become an intrusive thought? Does it reduce the frequency of those flashbacks? And amazingly, that's what we found. The over the course of the week that we were following up participants, the number of intrusions was lower in people who had had their memory put back into that modifiable state and played Tetris. And of course, we had control groups who'd only played Tetris or had only had the memory in the modifiable state or had had nothing. And not only that, but when we tried to provoke intrusions in the lab, they still had lower a lower frequency of intrusions, suggesting that
they weren't as affected by it.
They just weren't as affected by it. They just couldn't bring those images back to mind in the same way that the participants in the control group could.
Wow. So obviously next step is very carefully maybe speaking to people who have had PTSD and seeing if you can induce this sort of effect. But I presume that's wrought with complications if you're talking about someone who has a very troubling memory of gore from an accident or a violent episode.
Absolutely. So, of course, the advantage you have with lab-based studies is you know exactly what your participants have learned. So for the trauma film procedure, we know which film clips they've seen, and we know what we need to present to get them to remember those film clips in a way that's modifiable. Of course, for individual PTSD patients, no two people will have had the same experience of trauma. Even if it was the same traumatic event, no two individuals will have had exactly the same experience. So that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges in getting this kind of approach to work clinically. That said, some of the work done by Meryl Kint's lab at the University of Amsterdam suggests that this is possible if you have a very, very skilled therapist. If you can get people with PTSD to focus on what we call their trauma hotspots, the really worst moments of the trauma that people even avoid in their memories. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. But if you can get them to really engage and relive those, and to violate their expectations about what doing that will mean. So often patients feel that they don't want to engage with those memories because they, you know, they feel they'll have a heart attack or they'll go mad or they will have some kind of nervous breakdown, you know, all of these kind of expectations. If you can get people to engage with those hotspots and then test those assumptions, have you had a heart attack? Are you going mad? Or have you had a breakdown? And then at that point, then you give, in the case of Meryl Kint's work, you give propranolol. You then find, at least in her very small scale studies, that the emotional impact of those memories is massively reduced when you test them subsequently.
It's absolutely fascinating work. I can see why you devote your career to it. Neuroscientist at Cambridge University, Amy Milton, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Really interesting science and fascinating to learn about how our memories are made. Love to hear your thoughts on that. And if you have memories that you'd rather forget, what are they of, and how do... How do you feel about this idea of opening them up to be edited? You can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. Time now to look back at some of your comments from last week. And if you remember, we were speaking to Professor Alec Gallimore from the University of Michigan about the X3 thruster, this extraordinary propulsion system he's using to develop the technology a bit further. It's being used in space already, but he's working on this particular thruster that could theoretically get to the moon in 30 minutes and propel spacecraft through the cosmos at 500,000 miles an hour, 500,000 miles an hour, which is just mind-boggling and a multiple of what we're able to do at the moment. Some of you were impressed by it, but some of you not so much. Someone had emailed in anonymously saying, interesting, but it all sounds way too theoretical, nowhere near close to the scale and economy needed and the power. Megawatts? I've worked on 5 kilowatt thrusters and they're not cheap and mainly used for a few months of orbit insertion and then periodic station keeping. Definitely not continuous propulsion to get to warp speed, as we were calling it. David says, you said 500 miles an hour. Surely that's too slow. Yes, I meant 500,000 miles an hour, David. 500 miles an hour is not very fast in terms of space travel, but it's one of many mistakes I make per program. So apologies for that. Someone says, you're talking about a rocket with better fuel. Well, what they're talking about is it's plasma, and so the fuel is totally different. In fact, it's not a chemical propulsion; it's electrical propulsion. And so, yes, the fuel would be very abundant. We're talking about water, and one of the benefits of this is you could potentially pick up this fuel anywhere you want because water is the fuel needed for this plasma, not hydrogen or something else. Then someone is less impressed with this technology, saying, we traveled on foot usually, well, on feet, graduating to using trams with porthole windows and spiral steel staircases to the other upper deck. We were taken on holidays in a charabanc. When at the seaside, a scary treat was a trip up the cliff in the funicular railway. In Ireland, at Bray Head, a chairlift would take us up to the Eagle's Nest. What's that about modern travel? Spaceships? Bah. I'd love to know, I have to say, I don't know what age we're talking about now. Is this 50 years ago? Is it 70 years ago? But certainly none of those things were around in my childhood. But thanks for your email, listener. And Gordon says, what would happen in a collision with a small object at 500,000 miles an hour? Also, it would take the same time to decelerate, so it would be traveling. Would it be traveling at max speed for long? Very good question in terms of the collision, but I imagine you imagine it would go straight through anything, right? I mean, traveling at that speed, it would just poke a hole in anything. But what it would do to the spacecraft itself is difficult to know. And yes, it would take a long time to decelerate. But the point of this is that in terms of travel to get to outside our solar system or interstellar travel, these are at minimum the speeds that we'll need to be going. Stephen Doherty got in contact. He says, hi, Jonathan. Can you ask your guest how faster travel works when you approach your target? If it's way faster, then you either pass by the target too fast to study it, Or if you want to slow down, then the energy needed to slow the approach is much the same as the energy it took to get up to speed in the first place. More if you launched from Earth. Another option is to aerobrake, but that has potential dangers in heat as you slow through an atmosphere and potentially get closer to planetary objects like Saturn's rings. If you swing past a planet, you often accelerate, not slow down. Would more gentle, continual acceleration not achieve the same thing? Would an electric slingshot akin to a tank's shell not achieve a better option than burning fuel? Thanks for that, Stephen. So it depends on which way you're going, I would imagine. Feel free to correct me, but if you're traveling past a planet and it is spinning in the opposite direction to you, then there's a good chance that that will slow you down, I would have thought. I mean, if you're going with the turn of the planet, it would speed you up, and if it's going against, it would slow you down. So I do think it is possible to use gravity from planets and stars to slow down, although that how you use that at those sort of speeds on systems so far away, how that works, I'm not quite sure. I haven't heard of aerobraking. You know, this is something I think we might send on to Alec Gallimore. I thought we talked about how to slow them down, but maybe it didn't make it into the edit. So we might throw that question to Alec, Stephen, via email and get back to you. We got another email from a longtime listener, Pat Ormore, who says, "Hi, Jonathan, longtime fan of the show, bit behind the podcast, was listening to the Fusion one. I know this seems like a far-off prospect, but have people thought about using one of the world's most important compounds, i.e. water, as a fuel? Is it a good idea? Your guest mentioned using lithium, then converting the hydrogen gleaned from water and converting it to helium. Helium is an inert, noble gas that's not retained by Earth's gravity, so it's only found in isolated, non-porous pockets or is lost to space. Now, I'm sure it would take ages to use up Earth's water supply in this way, but I wonder, has anyone done the maths to work out how long it would take for water to become even more critical, considering it's already in short supply in many places of the world and under pressure because of the closed water cycle? Taking it out and literally destroying the water is not a great idea," is the gist of his email. He says, "I'm sure I'm making a mountain out of a molehill, but I bet 100 years ago people didn't envisage that our industrial pursuits would have such a profound effect on our climate." Good point, Pat. And he goes on to say, imagine a scenario 2 million years from now where there are two red rockets, there are two red planets circling the sun, one of them that exhausted all of its water to power golf carts. I do think the amount of water we're talking about in these systems is absolutely minuscule. And I think by the time we come close to exhausting a dangerous amount of it, we'll probably have figured out how to extract water from Mars. That said, you're absolutely right. No one has a crystal ball. Water is something we need, and using it to fuel enormous fusion reactors is tricky. But in comparison to what we're doing, it's a no-brainer, in my opinion. And finally, Tim Lavery says, "What can be learned from complex ant communities is truly amazing." This is on a completely different subject. We were talking to Deborah Gordon about the complex societies of ants, how they communicate and how they build these really clever structures on really basic lines of essentially programming code. I love that piece. We do them every once in a while on the program. We dig deep into behavior or the environment of a particular animal, and I'm always just blown away by, it's sort of patronizing in a way, by the ingenuity of nature. So I really enjoyed that as well. Glad you did too, Tim. That's it from us for this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing, Simon McKean, who was researching, and on sound, Jojo Cardozo. We'll be back with more Future Proof Extra in your podcast feed next week. In the meantime, stay curious and wear a mask. Thanks.